the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur, because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. Damn, we have a show for you today. This is an amazing one. Two and a half guests. We have someone playing the quick 10, so I'll count that as a half. But just two amazing guests and a great game of the quick 10. What else could you ask for? First up, we have Robert Collin. He is one of the environmental greats out there. He has had a huge impact in our societal fight for climate change and better environment. He has a book out on climate adaption, and he calls this current generation the climate adaption generation. Absolute fascinating conversation that we have. It's, of course, in honor of the new book that came out yesterday, The Real Environmentalist. And Robert was one of the people who was kind enough to help us with that. And so we have him on the show as part of our process of getting to know each other. And hopefully we will be able to work together in the future. I think we have a lot of synergies. At the end of this interview, Robert has a section where he describes a whole bunch of environmental entrepreneurship ideas. This is one of the best monologues I've ever heard of all of the opportunities that are available in environmental businesses that are going to make money and make the environment better at the same time. What an amazing topic. So you've got to check that out. Also, he calls me an oceanographer. I've never told you, it's a secret, but I actually did get a degree in oceanography about 500 years ago, and I have done extensive sailing on a research vessel. And so that is what he is referring to. Of course, that's mentioned in the book. After that, we have Vivian Vale. I have never seen someone with so much energy and excitement. She is the sales queen, specializing in high ticket sales. She is from Miami, and her story is unbelievable. The things that she has done, the energy that she has, and her commitment to trying and getting things done now and using your influence. Just an amazing interview. So I'm excited to share that with you. And then, as I said, we have an incredible game of the quick 10 with Rhea Wong is playing. Rhea Wong, she is the incredible fundraiser and the lady with the great glasses. We will be right back to get started. Go buy the book, Real Environmentalist, please. We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. I'm excited to introduce my first guest today. This is going to be an interesting one. And boy, is this a career. I very rarely have guests that I'm jealous of, but I am jealous of my guest, Robert Collin. He has taught, researched, and published in law, social work, and urban planning for over 40 years. Listen to this. He's been appointed to advisory commissions by 3 state governors and 3 presidents. He's published law reviews, 2 of which were the first in that genre. He's published 11 books total, including one on the EPA that is sort of the definitive work on that subject. He has published a new book called The Climate Adaption Generation, A Blueprint for the Future. And it was awarded the best climate change book of the year last year and is being considered for a Pulitzer Prize. Damn, Robert, welcome to the show. How you doing?
Good. Thank you very much. That's very nice. I'm also jealous of you. So we're jealous of each other.
Well, I'm jealous of your hair as well.
Yeah, thank you. There's a little bit left. I'll share some when it comes off in my brush.
Well, I don't know if I want that kind of hair. I just wish I had my own. So, Robert, fascinating career. What's your take on the environment? So, are you a denier or a truther, or, you know, how do you define your love of our environment, please?
Well, I grew up, you know, with farmers, and I spent a lot of time outdoors and, you know, hunting and fishing and so forth. And I always view nature as truth, not really decided by humans necessarily. So I go by land, air, and water, which is law. I've only been a part of two organizations, well, three counting my church, and two I created. One was the first environmental justice state agency, and called the Environmental Justice Task Force. California and New York, 10 years later, claimed they were the first. I wrote a law review article on this because I knew they would do that. So we laid claim to it early. It was unique in terms of being very, very inclusive. We had industry, we had communities of color, we had one environmentalist. They didn't really jump into join very fast, I have to say that. The other group was, while I was a professor at University of Oregon in environmental studies, it was a coalition against environmental racism. And the way that started is the kids of color, Asian, African American, Latino, came to me, and the big conference there is the Land, Air, and Water Conference at the law school. And these kids were saying they won't let us play. They won't include our issues. They don't like urban issues. They won't include brownfields in terms of redevelopment. And what I said, well, you have to learn to speak for yourself. You have to learn to advocate, and let's get organized. Here's your organization. We invited speakers to come. They stayed with us in our house that professors seldom do. We worked with the student government, something else professors seldom do, that helped fund the conference when none of the departments would fund it. So it was those two organizations I helped form, I've been a member of. But other than that, in my church, I've never been a member of any other club, fraternity, environmental organization, anything like that. I've been a serious, full-time, the environment speaks for itself researcher. So in terms of, I don't deny climate change. It changes all the time anyway. Nothing is ever the same. A truther, I've never really identified even with that term. We are experiencing climate changes. The argument I don't get into is whether they're human-induced or not. To me, that's blaming someone. That, to me, the lawyers jump in and want to find legal liability to find someone to sue. I'm not
Robert,
there.
That right there makes you a target, because we have to.
Oh, yes.
The mantra is we have to include humans as part of it.
So, oh, very much. Not a direct target, but never really included. The first article that my wife and I wrote for Georgia University Press was called Forever Wild, Forever Free. And we talked a lot about slavery and colonization and, you know, small businesses, or back then they were all kind of small by today's standards, as a way to freedom, really. And they wrote back and said, one, we will never publish this. And two, we will never allow you to publish this anywhere else. And just because when you submit it to be published to a university press, they control all of that, and, you know, including whether you ever submit it again.
I don't understand. Bob, help me understand this stupidity. They can't stop you from submitting it to my publishing company.
Well, they think they can. And my attitude is bring it, you know, go ahead. And you know what? We used pieces of that for almost every single thing in my 40-year career. So, you know, try to stop me from doing that. That is also, with a lot of the big publishing houses, one of the conditions of submitting your manuscript is that you submit it to no one else. And once you submit it, they consider they own it. So that's why they thought they owned it. You don't own an idea, really. You know, and a thought and an idea is one of the most powerful things in the world.
Robert,
so,
can I interrupt for a second?
Yes, sir.
Entrepreneur Magazine owns the word entrepreneur.
Yes, and you just used it. Are you going to pay them?
Every time I do, they bill me for 12 cents. So, but I did get sued by them. I did get a cease and desist. I'll be very, very precise. I wasn't sued. I got a cease and desist, and I called my lawyer, and the lawyer said, Jim, you are going to lose 100%. These people enforce this all the time, and they win every single time. And I was in shock, and they even made a movie about it. There's a movie called Trademark Wars, and it's the history of certain groups that spend more money enforcing their trademarks than actually doing good. Another one is the Cure for Cancer. Cure is owned by that organization, and they will sue you if you're trying to cure pancreatitis.
I think that's fundamentally wrong. And I think that stops the free flow of ideas, the free flow of us including each other in terms of trying to explore these things. I think the why they do it, in terms of your question, is to corner the market on that word so they control the thoughts that are associated with that word. And by me not being part of any organization, I'm free from those types of controls. Now, in terms of words that I have used, I'm probably, I'm on Social Security, so I'm probably pretty judgment proof. You can get a judgment, you won't be able to enforce it very much on that. And the voices that I've talked about in terms of using different terms like environmental justice and environmental racism, environmental equity, and I wrote the first law review article on that topic, and I chose the words very carefully. I used all three terms. And it just means a disproportionate impact of environmental decisions in process and in substance by race, class, and income. And I think environmentalism is elitist. I think they do not want to include the lower SESs, the socioeconomic status. And I think that's a problem and an obstacle to solving problems, just as much as people not letting us use the words that are in the dictionary. And so, it's not necessarily, Jim, the fact that they'll win if they sue you. It's a fact they'll tie you up with expensive lawsuits so that even if they lose, you've lost. And so the decision-making processes are such that it's really getting in the way. Now, in terms of argument and the rhetoric of persuasion, when you have nature on your side, you don't usually lose the argument. And so I've stuck to that on it. It is disconcerting to hear that someone like you, you're an oceanographer, you enjoy the outdoors, you are a proponent of sustainability. And to me, an entrepreneur is someone that takes risks just so that he or she can make enough money to pay for their family. And as I'm doing this book on climate adaptation generation, these kids have the most skin in the game, and they're the first ones that have to do something about it. And they are hitting a wall. That's why I have advocacy briefs there. A wall of bureaucracy, a wall of we just can't do it. Now, they're not great advocates. I've been a very good advocate on a lot of issues, but and you're a salesperson, I can tell. And what it is trying to get to yes. You try to get to yes. You don't make them a member of your club. You try to perhaps get them out of the way, but it's getting to yes. So when these kids get in front of a state legislature or a planning commission, they get angry. They name call. They get huffy like an adolescent would. They're not very good at trying to get to yes. So basically, my advocacy briefs, one, gives a lesson in civility, but two, helps them create empathy for decision makers that are in tough situations that control the power. Now, I talk about this in the digital divide. The older generation has the most disposable income. They control most of the political power in terms of senators, Supreme Courts, representatives, governors, and all that. So they have power and money, but they don't like AI. They don't agree with technology. They are slowing us. They are not letting us adapt to the changes that occur. And part of that, and here you and I share some issues, is that they aren't encouraging entrepreneurs to help us adapt. The case in point is fireproof paint. There's been a young man, well, he's not young anymore, but he had fireproof paint on the West Coast. As you know, that's burning up. I actually spotted, when I was in the mountains, one of the biggest fires ever to hit Oregon. And that, you know, it was so bad in Oregon, you couldn't get insurance companies to cover your mortgage, which froze the housing market. It's huge. Finance, insurance, and real estate got affected by that. So finally, this guy was able to break into the market and scale it up, which is something you've talked a lot about. Scale it up to the point it can be distributed where it's okay with homeowner associations, it's okay with local land use to have this kind of fireproof paint. Personally, things that I've done, my own personhood, when I lived in Salem, Oregon, I had a tile concrete roof. So I made a paint, not with a test tube, just like a farmer makes paint. I made white paint and I put bedazzled reflector things in it. And I painted myself by hand with a brush, my entire roof white, the color white, in total violation of the homeowner association. They didn't do anything, but that year, the state of Oregon had tax credits for energy saving activities. They had not included or excluded white paint. That paint cost me $411. So I deducted that from my taxes as an energy saving mechanism. The next year they have an express position saying, and we do not include white paint. 5 years ago, yeah, I walked the walk and talked the talk, but 5 years ago, New York City, I think it's 6 years now, they started a whole program of painting the roofs white. It's so simple. When it's white, it reflects heat. It saves energy. And this constriction of entrepreneurs coming up with fireproof paint and probably white paint with homeowner associations stops us from the simplest things that would save energy, that would help us adapt to climate changes in terms of extreme heat. And it's maddening to me. And it's fundamentally what drives the climate adaptation generation, as opposed to the climate resistant generation, crazy. They think they can just do it. Oh, I can just do what Bob did and pay my house. Like, sometimes you can and sometimes you can't. And so how do we stop flooding? We raise the roads. We make bigger culverts. There is an issue here where a 13-year-old boy got sucked down into a culvert and the emergency responders were heroic trying to save him, but he died. Now, how do you stop that? You make bigger culverts, you put a screen on them, and you train the kid about floods. The Texas case, you had 400 Boy Scouts downstream that had been trained on how to deal with a flood. They survived. Upstream, you had a bunch of kids that had never been trained. They died. So a very simple in the classroom technique of when a flood comes, move on it. There's other things. I've made a list of entrepreneurial opportunities in climate adaptation. Excuse me. Resilient infrastructure and materials, flood-resistant housing, modular, quickly deployable shelters. You know, Japan has been hit by tsunamis since we can remember the word tsunami. And they have created parks in Tokyo. No one is 30-minute walk away from a park. In these parks, the play equipment can become emergency shelters. Just snap it right on. It has floors, it has ceilings. It's designed so the wind will push it down instead of away. And another issue we don't talk about is waste. You know, no one likes to talk about it. One of my last encyclopedias was the Encyclopedia of Trash Talk, and it's not dirty words, it's waste and recycling. And so they're their playgrounds. They're on high ground, so it doesn't flood. And they made it so the sewer systems, you snap on a cap and it becomes a toilet so that you don't have waste and all the diseases that can come from that exposure floating around. Oakland, California, which is not a very wealthy municipality, is now adapting that to deal with some of their issues. So that's a climate adaptation based upon simplicity. And there are entrepreneurial activities and options and opportunities for this. Heat reflective and cooling materials. Another big area that I've been on for a long time is permeable pavements and stormwater management systems.
Permeable floor management system. Say it again.
Permeable pavement, like your sidewalks and stuff. And we have these massive shopping malls, or we used to have malls. That's, I guess, a thing of the past. Just non-porous. Water is truth. It goes where it goes. And if it doesn't absorb it, then it goes away. And this has been done in other countries. The Dutch are way ahead of us, and they're about under sea level right now, and they're still doing this. So they have great stormwater management systems. Some other stormwater management things are to keep wetlands wetlands. Other places are making wetlands. When you make a wetland, the cheap way is to just, plow it up and throw some rocks on it. Hope something grows. Well, we might have to invest more in that. And I know there are entrepreneurial opportunities in that. In terms of water and food security, smart irrigation systems that conserve water, drought-resistant crops and climate-adapted seeds, vertical and controlled environmental agriculture in terms of urban farming, hydroponics, and aquaponics, water harvesting, desalinization, and purification startups. There is a huge demand for those. In terms of climate risk data and analytics, real-time flood, wildfire, and heat risk predictions are a big deal. Right now, AI is more accurate in predicting the weather than most meteorological models. So if you're a farmer and you're trying to figure out when to hay or when to harvest your crops, and you need to know if it's going to rain, you don't necessarily turn on to, the TV station. You go and figure out what AI is having that. And it's even more advanced with computers assisting where the good areas are that need pesticides or herbicides or rodenticides or fertilizer, and the areas that don't. They have that dialed in. There are a lot of entrepreneurial activities with that. For health and well-being, for cooling technology, for heat waves, community cooling pots, which is what they're doing in India. And it's a central area that has a massive air conditioner that cool. It distributes.
Like downtown, you go get cold?
Well, a little more than that. They pipe it out. They pipe it out to dense urban areas from a cooling center like we just have. Well, it's going to be hot. Go to the mall. It's going to be hot. Go to, a cooling center. The city may set up in a homeless shelter. India is cooking. It is extremely hot. And so what they've done is create what we would call municipal cooling centers that create cool air and pipe it out. There are some opportunities with that here. The really big thing, and it's more your area of understanding than mine, are supply chain adaptation. Decision support tools for supply chain adaptation. You don't want to get stuck with something in the supply chain that doesn't move in terms of selling or whatever. But then you don't want to be stuck when someone wants it and can't get it. So decision support tools for supply chain adaptation, when a flood occurs, when a wildfire occurs. Those are the two big ones that most people are concerned about. But in my book... Go ahead, Jim.
We need to start paying attention to time, I'm afraid. But what were you about to say?
There's a lot of opportunities out there with this, and they're changing all the time. We will have big climate impacts. We have to be ready. The one last thing I want to put a plug in for, two things. Emergency responders, with the increasing natural disasters, we all become emergency responders. So I place them on a high level, and I include them in my book. Secondly, quickly, libraries are information emergency responders. There's a 10-year study that looks at that. When your cell phone goes down, you go to the library to find out where your kids are, where your family is, who's safe, when help is coming. So librarians and emergency responders are highly prioritized in my book, where you won't find a climate book that even mentions them.
Very good point. What did you think of my climate book?
I like it. The one I reviewed, I thought was right on point. You're quite cutting in terms of hypocrisy at individuals, where I do the same thing with institutions, but you're calling it out. And I think the real environmentalists are the ones that do environmental things. Now, when there was that fire in Hawaii, a bunch of PhDs went in there, and what they said there: roll up your sleeves, brother, and help us shovel this out. You know, it wasn't the command and control, and I'm the boss because I have a PhD. It was, we're all human. So your book brings in the fact that we need blue-collar people, men and women, to begin to do the types of things that really help us adapt to the environment. And we need to pay them, and we need to prioritize them, and we need to listen to them when they need the some help when they're getting started as a startup, which you're an expert in. So at first I thought, oh, this is just going to be a tirade against environmentalists, but it really wasn't. And it really showed that people are marketing the term "I'm an environmentalist" rather than really doing it. And it resonates with me. I feel strongly about it. I think you're one, I want you to, you know, be strong, because you won't be popular with everyone, but I wasn't either. Well, you know, that's what happens to truth tellers, on this. And I like it, as I said to you, that when someone says the emperor has no clothes, well, this emperor, by being naked, is getting in the way of the kids doing climate adaptation, and it makes us all suffer. And it will increase mortality. It will hurt vulnerable people, which is where I'm at in terms of protecting vulnerable people. And we're all vulnerable people. As an infant, as we're older, we all become vulnerable. So I think that we're on the same direction in terms of trying to get a real sense of how to do this now. Just get going on it. Don't do a command and control. They're ignoring the lower socioeconomic status people, both in terms of blue collar entrepreneurial activities, as well as listening to those communities that are really at risk as these natural disasters occur. Finance, and what I call fire, finance, insurance, and real estate, they don't have the bank. I mean, you couldn't buy a house after the big fires in Oregon. So it's time that everyone listens to the front lines. Black women that were in prison couldn't fight fires, even though they were trained in firefighting, because they had a record. We changed that in Oregon, and they are good workers, and they fight fires, and they do a good job on it. And so changing our attitude about who can and who can't really help climate adapt has to change tremendously. Right now, the education book I wrote was the preface I sent around to the bill sponsors for climate education in Oregon. That bill passed. Oregon is on the coast. They could have some big earthquakes and tsunamis. So just getting that term in there without it being politicized as a term, just doing emergency training. Here's where you go when the tsunami comes. Here's how you know an earthquake is getting worse. So just that type of empowerment with just plain common sense knowledge and providing opportunities for blue-collar, lower socioeconomic status people to get a job helping us adapt to the climate. You and I are on the same page with that, Jim, and I'm glad you wrote your book. You know, I support it. I think you should write more of it. I'd be happy to work with you. Anna, I'm sure we disagree about some things, but in terms of the reality, you've described it. And a reality I'm trying to change with the climate adaptation generation, a reality you're trying to change with the real environmentalists, Anna. And you know who's going to decide? Who's going to prove us right? Nature. When nature's on your side.
As you said.
That's right. And you know, when nature's on your side, you may not win in a court of law that where someone got the trademark on nature. But nonetheless, the actual proof is in the land, air, and water. What we breathe, what we drink, what we walk on, floods, fires, how many people live, how many people die. That will be the proof. I'd rather people live.
Robert, we only have 30 seconds left. How do we get in touch? What's your URL?
My email is colinrobert4@gmail.com, colinrobert4@gmail.com. I'm a regular guy, so you can call me at 503.
Oh, we can't give out telephone numbers.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm irregular in that regard. Email is the best way, and I have an Amazon authors page that you can contact me on.
Fantastic. Robert, thank you so much for being with us. We'd love to have you back, and we will be right back.
That's a great question.
Well, I think it's a great question.
It's great, great question.
Yeah, that's a really good question.
Okay, that's a great question. And
yeah, it's a great question. And
those are two great examples. Great, Jim.
Jim, I think that's absolutely perfect. That is exactly it.
School for Startups Radio.
We are back, and again, thank you so much for being with us. Very excited to introduce another great guest. Please welcome Vivian Vile to the show. She is the CEO and co-founder of the Air Insurance Group out of Miami, Florida. Very active in the industry and giving back to the space as well. She has had an impact on a lot of people, I think, and we're going to learn some more about that today. She's starting master classes and will teach you everything that she knows about what she has done to get where she is. And they call her the sales queen. Vivian, welcome. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for having me, Jim. I'm doing wonderful. How are you?
I am great. So tell us about the master class.
Yes. I'm the creator of Influence OS. And like you mentioned, I've gotten into sales about, it was 5 years ago when I got into the industry. I was going through the worst time of my life. And basically at that time, I was $500,000 in debt. I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life. I never had really worked for anybody in my life before. I was the CEO and CMO of my own companies. I've had some very successful companies. I sold some of them. I've had some horrible failures as well, like every single entrepreneur is out there. And that's when my rock bottom was right before COVID, 2020. And that's where I found an opportunity in sales, high ticket sales. Did not grow up thinking, hey, I want to be a salesperson, because, you know, everybody has this vision, like, you know, a dirty car salesman kind of stereotype of sales. But I desperately needed to find the money to feed my child and pay the rent. And that's when I found this opportunity. And I became obsessed. When I got in, I didn't know high ticket sales was a thing. I had no idea what it was, to be honest. But I found the opportunity and I became obsessed with figuring it out. At first, I learned this entire, you know, sleazy ball kind of way of selling, but I did make $38,000 in my first month. So it paid the bills, but it didn't feel right. And within the next few months, I really decided that I wanted to figure out how I was going to change the game. redesigned the way sales were done. And I became obsessed with books, with gurus, with coaching programs. And what I realized, a lot of these gurus and coaching programs, what they're doing, they're teaching the same stuff that keeps the industry churning around into that stereotype. And that's when I decided to change pressure to presence. And I created the Influence OS, which is the world's first influence operating system. And it's a framework which is powered by my Crown framework. So Crown stands for clarity, relationships, ownership, wealth, and neuroscience. And that's basically what it is. I now, my masterclass, which we're actually launching today, and you still have time to go into my website and sign up to get into the free masterclass tonight. My masterclass teaches everybody on how everybody is in sales. If you're a mom, if you're a dad, if you're a parent, you're in sales because every day you're trying to teach your kids on who they can be in life. If you're a wife, you are in sales because you are, you know, working every day with your husband on how to get his credit card to go buy whatever you want. If you are an employee, well, that's the truth. I mean, I know that. Ask my husband. If you're an employee, you're in sales because you are trying to motivate your staff every single day to come in and bring the best of them into their work and their results. If you are a leader, you are in sales because you are selling every day on the people that are following you, how they can be better. The question, it's not if you're in sales, because we're all in sales. The question is, are you going to be in sales through pressure or through presence? And my framework basically teaches everybody, this specific framework teaches everybody on how to utilize this system to completely change your life. So to give you a little bit of background here, back then, 5 years ago, I was $500,000 in debt. You know, something that's very vivid in my mind is just going up the stairs, my building shut down my elevator key. And because I had not paid the rent for 3 months, and I had to renew my lease, and without a new lease, I couldn't use the elevator key. So they couldn't get rid of me. They couldn't, you know, kick me out because of COVID, but I didn't have an elevator key to go up and down the stairs. So I remember going up the stairs with my son in one hand and the groceries on the other hand and just like crying my eyes out. And I found this opportunity. I literally cracked the code on how to do it right and how to rewrite the rules of sales. And within 6 months, I was making $100,000 a month. Within a year, I was leading a team doing $1 million a month. And then fast forward 5 years, my corporations, my companies are worth over $100 million. So it's being a game changer for me. And the problem is that a lot of people have the grit. They want to work. They're willing to do what it takes, especially entrepreneurs, but they don't have the right avenue. They don't have the right vehicle and they don't know how to do it in a way that goes with their values and in a way that will allow them to get to the level that they are trying to get. They tell themselves that they want to get, but they just don't know how to get there. And my masterclass does just that. I will actually be able to go through, it's going to be about 90 minutes, and I will go through my entire process, the A to Z's of everything that I had to do to go from $500,000 in debt, a single mom struggling, you know, to buy food for my son every single day, to living the life of my dreams. And yeah, it's going to happen on October 1st. I believe it's at 8 p.m., but you can go into my website and check out the details of it. And yeah, it's going to lay out the entire framework, the Crown framework, and the Influence Matrix, which is the method that I've created that you can utilize whether you want to get into sales and you want to do high ticket sales, or you can utilize if you're a business owner and entrepreneur and you want to scale your team and your organizations. Just so you have an idea, today corporations pay me over $250,000 for just one single day where I can teach them those exact frameworks for them to scale past, you know, $1 million a year. So it's going to be an incredible class. It's going to be an incredible community building experience as well. And I will be able to put it all there, and it's free. If you go into my website, you can sign up. And, you know, it's a great step for anybody that's looking to get out of their comfort zone and change their lives. I will be giving all my secrets away.
Can you wet our whistle a little bit and tell us some of the system now?
Yes, of course. So the Crown framework is based on a few things, right? So I'll break it down for you a little bit. So C is for clarity. The biggest problem that entrepreneurs have, or salespeople, or anybody that really works on like a 1099 mentality kind of thing. So sometimes you are not really an entrepreneur or business owner, but you are working for yourself. You're a freelancer, right? So if you don't do your job the right way, right, you can make money. So the first issue that people have when it comes to building a business or running your own business on a freelancing kind of type is clarity. A lot of times you will tell yourself you want to accomplish something or do something, but you really haven't made a decision. And the problem with that is because you might tell yourself you've made a decision, but you don't have the identity to support it. So the C is for clarity. The first step on changing your life is making a decision and rewiring your brain, your mindset, and most importantly, your identity to be able to match that decision. Have you ever met anybody that goes like, oh yeah, I want to be a millionaire?
Sure. Everyone wants to be a millionaire.
But then their actions and the things they say and the way that they see the world does not really match what a millionaire would do.
Yeah, they're not willing to do the work.
It's not just that. It's not just that, Jim. It's just not willing to. I was willing to do the work. I worked my booty off. I have this crazy obsessive personality. When I decide that I want to do something, I will do everything I could possibly do to make it happen. But my identity, the person I was, somehow in my subconscious mind did not believe or accept it that I was worth making more than $300,000 a year. Therefore, I was stuck at $300,000 a year. I was never able to pass that. When you work deep down into understanding, bringing clarity into your life to know who you are, what are you capable of, what do you need to do, and making a decision, unfortunately, I had to get to the very bottom of the ocean where I had two options. I would either die or I would wake up and swim back to the surface and start swimming. And that was the moment that I made that decision. So the clarity section of my framework is actually based on psychology and neuroscience, where I'm going to teach you exactly what I had to do to make that decision, to swim up, up, get the air and start swimming to shore to be able to save myself. So that's the clarity. Then you go into relationships. If you think about sales, if you think about leadership, if you think about, you know, being a business owner, being an entrepreneur, you know, or like even being a real estate agent or any business and enterprises out there that you are in a leadership position, or you are dealing with anything that will allow you to rise to the level of expectations that you want to be, what is the one thing that you know that is always part of it? Relationships. So how can you utilize your relationships, and how can you create the relationships in your life to allow those opportunities to rise so you can break that income ceiling? The third thing is going to be ownership. The majority of the people that you will meet will tell you that they want to have the level of success that I've achieved, right? So if you go on my Instagram account and, you know, everything that you see on Instagram is not real. It's all like fairy tales, right? We get the best pictures, the best videos, the best life, and we'll put it on Instagram. And so don't believe everything you see on Instagram, but you're going to go on my Instagram and you're going to see my pictures. You're going to see the pictures of me and my kids and my yacht, and you're going to see my cars, and you're going to see my businesses, and you're going to go, oh my God, I really, really, really want to have a life like this. The problem is most people are not willing to go through the 14 flights of stairs carrying the groceries and the kid and deciding to make a change. The door knocking when I was 7 months pregnant from 7 o'clock in the morning until 9 o'clock at night to be able to turn my life around. The moment that my son was born, I was back in the field with a, you know, breast pump, getting the milk for my baby. You know, literally, this is a true story, Jim. I was pumping the milk between appointments. I had a cooler in the back of my car. I was putting the milk bags on the cooler And with ice to make sure that the milk was still good. So the next day when I left at 7 o'clock in the morning again, my son had milk and my husband could feed him because I was in the field doing all the work that I needed to do to build the business that I dreamt of, right? So that comes the ownership part. What are the steps that goes within the ownership that I had to take to be able to break through those income ceilings, to break through that dream life that I wanted to have? So, and that is something that people need to understand. Now, again, there are actual proven steps, proven exercises, neuroscience-backed data that you need to learn to be able to make sure that those steps get into your brain and help you rewire your brain to get to that level. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And then the fourth part is wealth. So in the beginning, when I first started my journey to be able to become the sales queen, and I usually say, you know, there's Vivian and there's the sales queen. They're different people. Vivian is the mom, the wife, the friend. The sales queen is the leader, is the CEO, is the speaker. And they're different people. The sales queen is my alter ego. And one of the books that I love the most in this world is called The Alter Ego Effect. And it talks about that, how for you to become the person you dream of, you're going to have to create an alter ego. So when it comes into the wealth section of it, I have proven steps of the things that I needed to do. And then there's going to be my entire sales training in there, how to speak, your physiology, everything that you need to do from start to finish when it comes, whether you're going into become a high ticket sales, you know, rep, or you're going to implement high ticket sales techniques into your business to allow you to grow your revenue, or you're going to implement just the influence section of what high ticket sales allowed for me to learn, which is sales is not pressure, it's presence. It's proven neuroscience. And I'll go through my entire data that I've gathered in the last 5 years. Neuroscience shows with proven data that if you try pressuring people, it backfires. Your amygdala immediately go into fire mode, which basically pushes people away. So I will give everybody my entire system on how to create wealth with this framework on that section of wealth. And then the last part of my crown framework is neuroscience. So I am, everything that I teach, Jim, is backed up by all of the research I've done in the last 5 years to build this system. And just so you understand a little bit of what this system has done for me, when I was just using my training and everything that the people that I worked with taught me, you know, my first, like I said, I'm a little bit of a crazy person. So when I decide to do something and decides to do something, my first month in the industry doing high ticket sales, I made $38,000. And to me, yeah, I got into the industry for the money. I stayed in the industry for the people, for the relationships. So at some point, money just doesn't motivate you anymore. And I just felt that I wasn't doing the things that I was doing the right way. It just didn't go with my values, right? So when I started researching and creating this framework, what that did for me is in 6 months, I was making 100. In 7 months, I was making 150. In 12 months, a million. In 5 years, companies over $100 million. That is what mastering the art of influence can do for you. It completely removes those income ceilings. So this framework will allow you to implement the art of influence in anything that you want to do. So I have people that I work with in my coaching programs that they're not even specifically in sales, right? They are entrepreneurs, but they're capped and they want to completely scale their company and they just don't know where things are going wrong. And when they master that, everything changes. So that's a little bit of what the framework is and what we're going to do in the masterclass. And, I will be able to just break down my entire process and it's free. So people can really take a lot of value from it and start implementing right away.
Fantastic. And that's at 8:00 tonight, October 1st.
Yes, I believe so. And don't quote me on that, but I think it's at 8:00. You can go into my website, vivianvial.com. And I will spell that for you. It's Vivian, V-I-V-I-A-N. And my last name is W as in whiskey, E as in Edward, Y as in yellow, L as in Larry, L as in Larry.com.
Fantastic. Vivian, thank you so much for being with us today. Very interesting. You have so much excitement. It just bubbles over to the rest of us. I'm sure it'll be that way in the masterclass. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me, Jim.
All right. And we will be right back. We are back and have another brave contestant willing to play the Quick 10. Please welcome Rhea Wong to the show. She is a fundraising expert, focusing specifically on nonprofits. I heard you want to play our little game, the Quick 10.
I'm ready. Let's do it, Jim.
All right. Do you want to accept the standard wager? Do you want the standard wager?
What is the standard wager?
The bet that everyone else makes.
Okay. What is
there
the bet?
There you go. Number one, your favorite creativity hack.
Going for a walk without your phone to juice up your creativity.
Number two, favorite bootstrapping trick.
Trade services. If you don't have money, you can early on trade services with people to get the resources you need.
Number three, name your top passions.
Teaching, writing, travel, good food, helping people.
Number four, the first three steps in starting a business are?
Decide who you want to serve, test if they'll pay, and build only what solves their problem.
Number five, the best way to get your first real customer is?
Oh, pick up the phone, call someone you know, ask about their problem, offer to solve it, cheap or free.
Number six, your dreamiest technology is?
AI all day. Takes the admin work off my plate so I can focus on strategy.
Number seven, best entrepreneurial advice?
Decide fast. You'll learn quicker from a wrong move than you will from endless procrastinating.
Number eight, worst entrepreneurial mistake.
Thinking that hustling is equal to progress. So I spent so much time chasing shiny objects instead of just focusing on what works.
Number nine, favorite entrepreneur and why?
Alex Hormozi really cuts through the noise with frameworks and is focused on results.
Number 10, favorite superhero?
Wonder Woman, strength, truth, and awesome accessories.
All right, fantastic. We are calculating your score to find out the winner. While we do that, what's your website?
www.riawong.com.
Fantastic. I'm still just, I'm so sorry. You got a 94. Apparently, we had a judge from New Jersey, and you got a 94. You have to have a 95 to win. You have to have a 95 to win. So you owe us a Tesla. We always play for a Tesla.
Okay, I will. It's in the mail, friend.
Okay, I trust you.
All right.
Never lie.
I would never.
Thanks for being with us, and we'd love to have you back.
Thanks so much, Jim. Take care.
We are out of time, but back tomorrow. Be safe, take care, go make $1 million, and go buy the book, Real Environmentalist. Please. Thanks. Bye.